Well, good morning. It's usually I say it's good to be with you all today, but it's just a couple of us in here. But it's good to know that we can still interact with you and we can still share with you this morning. And so thank you for joining us online. And I just encourage you too, if you are taking part in this and watching us, just let us know that you're watching. Leave a comment on the Facebook page or on our YouTube stream, and just say hi. Let us know that you're tuning in, and we want to be able to take care of you and help you during this time, as Pastor Jerry said. So just make sure that you contact us, you communicate with us, and you let us know what's going on in your life, what your needs are, and I just want to remind you too that we, as we've said in previous days, just because we need to be socially distant doesn't mean that we need to be relationally distant. So care for each other, call each other. This is a great day to call those that you're usually here worshiping with, those family and friends. Check in on each other and just have a conversation, saying hi, we love you and we miss you, and you can do the same with us. With everything going on, typically we're in a series going through 1 John together as a church. But with everything that's been happening, we wanted to pause and just really address what's God's role in everything that's happening. What's God's role in this crisis? And so. We're going to be looking in the book of Lamentations this morning to figure that out. If you have your mobile device, if you're not watching us on your mobile device and you want to follow along with us, you can go to, if you have a YouVersion Bible app, you can go to that. And then if you click on the More tab, there it should usually be at the bottom. If you click on the More tab and go to Events, and then just search Bethel Erie, one word, you'll find us right there. Underneath More Events, and then search Bethel Erie. You can find us there. You'll be able to follow along with the verses that we're looking at. If you don't have that app, that's all right. The verses will be on the screen for you this morning. But you can go to BibleGateway.com. And if you go to BibleGateway.com and then you search Lamentations 3, then you can follow along there too at BibleGateway.com. We'll be using the New International Version, the NIV. And so those two things, the YouVersion, More Events, search Bethel Erie, and then BibleGateway.com, Lamentations chapter 3, is where we're going to be this morning, and verses, specifically verses 21 to 23, but we'll get to that. But just recently, I watched a podcast called 15 Days That Shook the World. I use Bing for searches. Don't judge me, all of you Google search people out there. Don't judge me for using Bing. But I typed in what is, and autofill showed me that currently among the most common searches were what is coronavirus, what is martial law, what is recession, what is a virus, what is a ventilator. Also, you know, autofill gave me two, why is everyone buying toilet paper? And if you can answer that for me, I would love to know the answer, because at some point you have to think everybody has enough, right? Like, why nobody should be needing to buy more, because so there should be it, but I don't get it. But you can't go on social media without the millions of disease experts out there posting opinion after opinion. All of them are supported by facts, and all of them somehow are disagreeing with each other. Right, every keyboard warrior out there has their own facts and their own thoughts, and every one of them disagrees with each other, and there's all these different opinions about it. And really, this whole thing, it feels insane. It feels crazy. Everybody seems afraid. Everybody feels worried, and we're told this is a crisis. And so for just a little bit this morning, let's just shut all that out. You don't need to look at any news articles this morning. You don't need to read any posts like that this morning. Let's just pause and let's ask this incredibly important question. What's God's role during this crisis? What about God? I think the answer to this question, I believe, can completely change for you the days ahead. And so to answer that question, what about God? What's God's role in this? We're going to be looking at the writings of a man named Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived in Jerusalem, Israel, in the late 500s BC. So that was about 2,500 years ago. And the reason that that's significant is because some major things were happening in Israel during that time. That time is the age of empires. And so little by little, history is moving towards world empires, specifically moving towards Alexander the Great and then Rome, empires you might have heard of. And each empire in sequence is growing bigger than the previous one that it took over. And then it gets replaced by another one that becomes slightly larger and so on and so on. So the Babylonian Empire is in the middle of this cycle. And eventually the Babylonian Empire will become the Persian Empire led by a man named Xerxes. You may have heard of him too. But when Jeremiah is alive, that empire is led by a king called Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar had expanded his empire beyond the borders of Iran and Iraq, which is where it started, and it now includes, during this time, Israel and Jerusalem. And the king of Jerusalem at that time was named Zedekiah. And as Nebuchadnezzar expanded, Zedekiah, the king of Israel, Jerusalem, said, you know, it would be smart of me to join this Nebuchadnezzar rather than fight him. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to fight him. We should join him. And so he did. And because of it, he was left on the throne of Jerusalem, but he was answerable to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonian Empire. Jeremiah, our writer this morning, is in Jerusalem when all of this happens. And this is how he starts the text we're going to be looking at this morning. So we're looking at Lamentations chapter 3. I want you to see how he starts our text in verse 1 of Lamentations chapter 3. He says, Jeremiah, he's writing this book called Lamentations. He says, I am the man who has seen affliction. I am the man who has seen affliction. And this is really why we're reading Jeremiah's writing, because what he just wrote, I am the man who has seen affliction, that's an understatement. Jeremiah is a man who has seen affliction, yes, but in fact, what Jeremiah calls affliction is something sometimes translated misery. Really, Jeremiah has seen personal and national misery. He has seen crisis. And so I want to explain that to you and then see how we can be encouraged during our crisis. So when King Zedekiah allied with Babylon, things were great. Until a rumor began to spread to Babylon that Zedekiah was allying with the Egyptians, the Babylonians' enemy, because they wanted to break free from Babylon. And this rumor went around. And Zedekiah was thinking about doing that. So Babylon began a year and a half conquest of Israel to react to that rumor. They began to conquest Israel despite the fact that they had allied with Zedekiah. And Jeremiah, our writer, was directed by God to tell him, look, to tell Zedekiah, look, Egypt, this is what's going to happen. Egypt is going to leave you high and dry. And when they do, Nebuchadnezzar is going to run you over and burn Jerusalem to the ground. And after he told Zedekiah that, Jeremiah decided, I should head home. I'm going to go home. His home was in Bethlehem. And so he decides, I should go head out of Jerusalem. And on his way out of the city, he stopped at the city gate and accused of deserting to the Babylonians. And so Zedekiah and his guard throw Jeremiah in a makeshift jail where he's starved and becomes incredibly sick. And he is there in that jail for 18 months. He's being starved. But then because of growing frustration and bitterness towards him, because Babylon encircles the city of Jerusalem, they lay siege to Jerusalem, and people become really, really frustrated with their conditions, they take it out on Jeremiah. And so he's lowered into an empty well in the middle of the courtyard of the royal barracks, where he is up to his knees in mud. Jeremiah, starving, dying in the mud, in this disease-filled pit in the middle of this courtyard where there's already not enough food, has seen affliction. In fact, the only reason Jeremiah gets out is because somebody feels bad for him, because he's almost died of starvation in a well that they ended up needing. They realize we're under siege. We need this well. We can't have a guy dying in our well. And so he's taken out of the well, but then he's chained in the middle of the courtyard for 4 months. He's left outside in the middle of this courtyard until the day the Babylonians break through the walls of Jerusalem. Jeremiah is a man who has seen affliction. That's what he says in chapter 3, verse 1. I am the man who has seen affliction, misery, crisis. But the end of the conquest of Israel was misery for the whole city of Jerusalem. It was a national crisis. For the last 4 months, the city was surrounded and trapped. They had run out of food, and those who survived did so by boiling leather, eating plants, and whatever else they could scrounge. They looked everywhere they could in the city for food. And when the Babylonians broke through the walls, they ravaged the city. They deported 20,000 of the richest and smartest of the population. They burned down what remained and then left the poor and the sick who hadn't been killed or enslaved. They left those people to live in the ruins of this burnt city. Jeremiah was ironically saved from his imprisonment by Nebuchadnezzar himself, which gave him the opportunity to write about the experience that he had. And so he says, Jeremiah says, Lamentations chapter 3, verse 1, I am the man who has seen affliction. This may be easier for you to relate to today than it was 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, it might have been harder for you to say, I'm a person who has seen affliction. I'm a person who has seen crisis. For time, we won't read everything that Jeremiah writes in this text. But Jeremiah goes on to describe his situation in great detail, and he struggles with where is God in this crisis, in his misery. In fact, he has this struggle with wanting to blame God for this crisis, for this misery, and he summarizes the whole situation in Lamentations chapter 3, verse 17. And in Lamentations chapter 3, verse 17, he says, I have been deprived of peace. I have forgotten what prosperity is. So I say, my splendor is gone, and all that I had hoped from the Lord. Right? My splendor is gone, all that I had hoped from the Lord. That's what he says. My peace and prosperity has been taken. All that I hope is gone. And he says that it makes him bitter. He says it makes him feel discouraged to think back over the last days, the last weeks and last months. It makes him frustrated. It makes him bitter. It makes him discouraged to think back over everything that has happened in the last amount of time. And I think that that's pretty relatable for us, where we think back to where we were 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and then we begin to think over the course and the actions that we've had to take because of this concern for this virus, because of this crisis in our nation, and it might cause us to feel that bitterness, that discouragement, that frustration, that concern. And a lot has seemingly changed overnight for us. Many are afraid to lose their jobs and their income. Many are losing their jobs and their income, and we're concerned for the health of those that we love. We're overwhelmed by tragedy that we see taking place in other countries and in other states, in other communities. We are seeing affliction. And it can cause us to struggle with where is God in this crisis? Maybe some people aren't sure God exists, and this reinforces that doubt. How could God be real when there are things like this crisis? Or maybe it causes people to wonder, did God cause this? Did God cause this crisis? If God is there, what is he doing? Because it seems like he's doing nothing, and it has left us feeling bitter. It has left us feeling discouraged or scared and concerned. And if I had to guess, at least one of those two words, bitter or discouraged, probably describe how everyone has felt at some point over the last week. I would guess that you have felt bitter or discouraged with the current crisis. That's how Jeremiah feels. He says, I have been deprived of my peace. I've forgotten what prosperity is. And so I say, my splendor is gone. All that I had hoped from the Lord, it's gone. And just when Jeremiah is being lost in his discouragement, he writes the verses we're going to look at this morning, beginning with verse 21, Lamentations chapter 3. Just when he is lost in his discouragement, he writes this, verse 21, yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. In that bitterness and that discouragement, Jeremiah makes a choice. He asserts his will. He says, I'm going to call this to mind. He asserts his will. He sets aside his emotions for a moment and focuses on something that has the potential to change the tone, change the direction of life And it causes him to write, what he focuses on, what he calls to mind, causes him to write, yet I have hope. Despite being the man who has seen affliction, misery, crisis, been starved nearly to death, seen all of this national tragedy, Jeremiah is able to stop and pause and say, because of this fact, I have hope in all of this. And his hope comes from God's role in the crisis. I want you to see what gives Jeremiah hope despite the affliction, despite the misery that he has witnessed, the crisis he and his nation have been through. It's in the next verse. So verse 21 of chapter 3, Jeremiah says, "This I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness." In short, what Jeremiah concludes and what I want us to remember this morning is that true hope in crisis comes from God because God is faithful. And that's what I want us to remember from what Jeremiah writes this morning, is that true hope in crisis comes from God because God is faithful. But what does he mean when he writes this? What does he mean when he says that because of the Lord's great love in verse 22, we're not consumed? Does that mean, because we can read that and we might think, well, maybe that means because of God's great love, we're not consumed. You might draw the conclusion that that means that God only loves those people who don't get sick. And because some people don't get sick or die, that those are the ones that God loves. Because of his love, we are the ones that aren't going to be consumed. And you look at that and you think, well, if that person got sick, maybe it's because God doesn't love them. That's not what Jeremiah is saying. That's not what this means. Remember, Jeremiah is writing in a specific situation that happened to Israel, a specific group of people in Jerusalem. It's a situation that's specific to his nation of Israel. But we can still pull truth from it to help in our nation's time of crisis, in our time of crisis. And everything that Jeremiah is saying here is reinforcing the truth that God is faithful. So the first thing to know is that Jeremiah uses the word Lord in verse 22. Because of the Lord's great love, we're not consumed. Now, I've been saying God. I've been using the word God instead of Lord, but that's because they're the same thing. The word that he uses is a very specific word for God, the word Lord. In most Bibles, in the version you're looking at, it's usually written in all capital letters. That's a very specific Hebrew word. That's Jeremiah's language. It's been translated into English. It's the personal name of God. The name is Yahweh. Sometimes you might hear people call it Jehovah. That's the personal name of God. And packed into that one name is the entirety of God's character. It's a name so significant to the Jews, to Jeremiah's day, that they wouldn't say it out loud. At the core of the name Yahweh is the Hebrew verb to be, meaning Yahweh is the one who is, the one who exists. It's a simple concept that God is, that God exists, but it has so much depth. The one who exists, God is self-existent, forever existent, existent over and above everything, existent close to and near everything. That's where the Bible starts. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, the Bible starts with these words: "In the beginning, God, Yahweh, the one who is before and above everything, God created the heavens and the earth." Everything starts with God. And there is only one God, Yahweh. God created everything. Look up. Those are the heavens. Whatever you see, God made. Look down and around you. Look out your window this morning. That's the earth. God made all of it. Its complexity and its design all point to God. God is the architect and the author of everything good. This is what another writer from Jeremiah's time, his name is Isaiah, he says in his letter, his book, Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28, Isaiah writes this. He says, "Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He's the everlasting creator God. He is the one who is, who exists, the only God, the creator of everything. Jeremiah's hope in crisis is rooted in the fact that God, the only God, the creator, is faithful, is dependable, is consistent, constant, and true. What does it mean that his faithfulness is great? That's what he says in verse 23. Your compassions never fail, they're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness, Yahweh God. What does that mean? Jeremiah explains it by saying that we're not consumed. That's what his faithfulness means, that we're not consumed. His compassions never fail because he's faithful. We're not consumed because he's faithful. But what does it mean that God's faithfulness is great? Because again, there was a crisis and people starved during Jeremiah's time. How can it bring hope that God is faithful when there are people who are getting sick, who are starving during his time? How can you still say that God is faithful? One of the core pieces of God's character wrapped up in his name is that he is faithful to his promises. He keeps his promises. Again, remember that Jeremiah is writing about a specific situation and an event in Jewish history specific to the nation of Israel. At the beginning of their history as a nation, God chose the nation of Israel to be an example to the rest of the world, of what it was like to live life under the rule of God. What would it be like to have God as your king? What would it be like to live a life following God's direction? And God chose Israel to demonstrate to the world what that was, to live a life in relationship with God. And so Israel, the nation, together made an agreement between God and themselves that he would be their God, and preserve them and prosper them and not abandon them, and they would obey him. This is where the Ten Commandments come from. I'm sure you've heard of the Ten Commandments. And that's where they come from. It's part of the agreement where Israel said, we will be your people, and God said, then I will be your God. I promise to be your God. Obey these things, and we'll be fine. It's part of Israel's side of the deal, the Ten Commandments. But they were bad at obeying and following God. They were bad at living a life under his rule in relationship to him. And so as a consequence of their rebellion against him, the Babylonians, the empire that we've been talking about during Jeremiah's time, because Israel was so bad at obeying him and following him, as a consequence, the Babylonians were allowed to come in and take over the nation of Israel. But when Jeremiah looked at the situation, as bitter and as discouraged as he was, what he realized is that despite it all, God had in fact been faithful to his covenant with Israel. Despite what he was witnessing in his nation, God had in fact been faithful to his promise to Israel that he had made. Despite the tragedy, God had preserved them as a nation because the Babylonians decided to value 20,000 of the brightest in Israel, and even many of the poor were spared and still lived. And history will show that throughout Israel's history, God has always been faithful to his word, his promise, his commitment to the people he chose. He has always been true to that. They were not consumed because God is faithful to his promise. In fact, Jeremiah credits the fact that they were not consumed, God's faithfulness to his promise, he credits that to God's great love. He says, because God's love, that God was faithful to his promise. Because of God's love, we were not consumed. Because of God's love, his mercies were new every morning. And that word love, that's what he says in verse 22. That word love, it's not the emotional word that we use today. Jeremiah was writing in Hebrew, and that's been translated into English, and the easiest word that we have in the smallest amount of space to fill in there is love. But the longer explanation of that word is willful loyalty and devotion to someone or something that doesn't depend on emotion, on how you feel, doesn't depend on affection, but on choice. It's a willful devotion and loyalty based on choice and unconditional loyalty. promotion of the other person before yourself out of a choice, out of loyalty, out of will. That's the love that causes God to ensure that his people were not consumed. God's commitment to the people he chose and promised to is great. His commitment, his devotion, his loyalty to his promise and the people he promised to was great. And Jeremiah sees his compassion. He sees God's mercy in withholding the worst, in preserving those people because he promised. Really, he sees that renewed every single day. He is a faithful God. Evident every morning that Jeremiah wakes up and sees God has still been faithful to his promise. And every morning that we wake up, there is the opportunity for us to see that God is still faithful. His mercy is new every morning. Yesterday when we woke up, we had another day, another chance, another opportunity. And if you were able to take the time to just quiet down for a moment, we can easily be reminded that his mercy is new every morning. It's refreshed, and we can see that his promise is still there. But what does that have to do with us today? What promise are we talking about today? In the crisis that we face today, even right now, how can that give us hope? Because we are not Israel. Jeremiah was writing about God's promise to Israel, the nation of Israel, and that Jeremiah can look and see God's promise to Israel is still valid. It's still good. He's still faithful to it. Every time I wake up, I can see that you're being merciful to your promise and your people Israel. But what about us? Is God still being faithful to us? Even despite the concern and the discouragement or bitterness or fear that we feel about what's going on in our world, is God still being faithful today? Well, first thing to remember is that God doesn't change. God is still Yahweh. He is the one and only God. He is the one who is and always is. He is constant no matter what. The God that Jeremiah was confident in is still the same God today that we can be confident in as well. God is still keeping, we can see it, God is still keeping his promise to the Jews. But God also made another promise that he's been faithful to, and he continues to be faithful to it, and that faithfulness to that promise can give you hope, can give hope to those who are part of that promise. If you look in Lamentations chapter 3, just down a few verses in verse 25, Jeremiah says, "The Lord is good to those whose hope is in him, to the one who seeks him." That God is good to those who hope in him. So here it is in a nutshell. In a similar way that there was danger to the nation of Israel, but God was loving towards them, unconditionally giving towards them, withholding that significant danger and punishment from them, being consistent and constant and preventing them from being consumed. There is still significant danger to all of us today, but maybe not in the way that you think. We imagine that there is significant danger out there for us because we're worried about this virus. We're worried about getting sick. We're worried about those loved ones getting sick. And we think, well, yeah, it is dangerous today. There is danger out there for me today. But there's another danger that you might not think about as much. What we're witnessing, this crisis due to a virus, is really the result of sin. Romans chapter 5, verse 12, the author there is a man named Paul. And he writes these words. He says, "Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, in this way death came to all people because all sinned." See, there's still a danger out there. And what we're witnessing with this virus, it's a result of sin. See, death, badness, evil, none of that was a part of God's created plan. But it came because the first man and woman, Adam and Eve, they chose to not honor God. And as a result, sin was introduced in the world. Sin as a corrupting force that polluted everything. It polluted creation. and causing things that are bad and evil in the world, like viruses, but it also corrupted people and their motives and their intentions and their behaviors and actions. And we know when we, and so some of you might be thinking, well, I don't know about this sin thing. I don't know if I buy it, that it's real. But we actually can tell that sin isn't natural, that sin is, that those evil things, those bad things, that it's not a part of the plan, but it's a significant issue. We know that. The one way that we know that is because death feels wrong. See, death wasn't part of God's plan, and death feels wrong. When someone close to us dies, even the fear of someone close to us dying, we know deep down inside this shouldn't happen. This isn't right. People weren't meant to die. Loss isn't okay. This seems bad. And you're right, it is bad. It is wrong. It's not natural. It's a result of sin. And the second thing that we know is that we can see, because we can see that sin isn't natural, one, because death feels wrong, but also two, because we do things all the time, you do things all the time that you don't want to do, but we can't explain why. I don't know why I did that. I didn't want to do that. I know it was wrong. I just did it. That same author, Paul, he writes these words in Romans chapter 7, verse 18. He says, I know that good itself doesn't dwell in me. That is in my sinful nature, my nature inside that's corrupted by sin. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I can't carry it out. We've all been in the situation where we have done something that we know was just plain wrong, and we did it anyway, and then we look at that and we think, why did I do that? It's because of sin. Because inside you, there is a force that has corrupted you and causes you to do things that you don't want to do. It causes death, which we know deep inside is wrong. It's not right. It's not supposed to be. Sin has corrupted everything. And the problem is that the nature of sin is that it must be punished and one day eradicated, because sin as a force stands in opposition to God. It stands in opposition to his design and his plan. The sin inside us comes with a price. Paul again writes these words. He says in Romans 6:23 that the wages of sin, the payment of sin, the consequence of sin is death. Ephesians chapter 2, it's the same author, a different letter. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1, Paul writes this. He says, as for you, you were a dead man walking in your transgressions and sins. You were dead. That's where you were headed. But then in verse 3, he says, all of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature deserving of wrath. Sin inside us comes with a price. Sin inside us stands in opposition to God. And as a force that's opposing God, God will eradicate sin. And the problem is, it's inside us. And the issue is, it's a cycle that we can't break out of. We sin, and so we deserve punishment. But because we sin, and we have sin inside us, we continue to get it wrong. We keep proving that it's inside us. We will always fall short of the expectations that God has for the creation that he made. We will never be able to look back on any day in our lives and say that we didn't on this day offend in some way the God of the universe, Yahweh God, the one who is, always is, that made us with hope and dreams for us. We can't say any day of our lives looking back that we didn't offend him somehow. And that deserves consequence. It deserves punishment. However, God offers us a gift. He offers us a promise. John chapter 3, verse 16, this is written by a man who was putting together a biography of Jesus. And so he offers this commentary on something that Jesus said. In John chapter 3, verse 16, he says this. He says that God so loved the world that he gave his, and there's that word love again, he devoted, he chose, that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. That word perish means separation from God. Paul, the author we've looked at a couple times here in another letter, Galatians chapter 1, verse 4, he says that Jesus Christ gave himself for our sins to rescue us from the present evil age according to the will of our God and Father. The promise, not the promise to Israel that God would not consume them because he promised that he would be their God, the promise to us is that whoever believes in Jesus won't suffer the eternal consequences of sin, the sin that's inside them. That's the danger that Paul calls the present evil age in the verse we just saw. The present evil isn't the coronavirus. The present evil is that we are all in significant danger because of sin. And it's something that is inside our nature. It's already inside you. You can't catch this from outside. It's already in your nature as a person. And so there is nothing that you can do, no antidote, no vaccine that you can take to fix the fact that sin is already inside you. The only thing that can address that and save us from the final outcome is a belief in Jesus. What that means is if you place your belief in this truth, God is real. Sin is real. Jesus was the explanation of a sinless God in human flesh. He was real. Jesus' death on the cross was real and served humanity by providing salvation from the penalty, the power, and the presence of sin. Sin, which is an insurmountable object, an obstacle that we all face in our lives. And if you believe that his resurrection from the dead was real, and that because of that he has promised to save those who believe from God's wrath on sin, if you genuinely believe that God is real, sin is real, Jesus is real, he really died, but he really rose, and because he rose, he's promised that if you believe those things, he will come back and save you from the consequences of sin. If you believe that, then God has promised you will be saved. He has promised that he will never leave you. He will never give up on you. He will never turn his back on you, despite any crisis that you might see outside, despite any discouragement, bitterness, and fear you might feel because of the current situations. God has promised he will never leave you. He will save you. He will never turn his back on you. He has promised to always comfort you, always guide you, always direct you, always protect you if you believe that truth. Does that mean that times won't be hard? No. Does it mean that we will have everything that we want? No. Does it mean that I might not get sick? No. But it means that we have hope. It means, like Jeremiah said, the Lord is good to those whose hope is in them. And that because God is faithful, Jeremiah says, I have hope because God is faithful to his promise. No matter what, we have hope because God has great faithfulness to the ones that he has promised. As Paul said in Romans chapter 8, verse 28, he says this. He says, we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have devoted and given their belief in their lives to him, who have been called according to his purpose. God is working for the good of those who have chosen to devote themselves to him according to his plan. Jeremiah concludes his thoughts this way. In Lamentations chapter 3, verses 40 and 41, he says this. He says that, let us then, because of this, let us then examine our ways and test them. And let us return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and our hands to God in heaven. And so that's our challenge this morning. Because we look outside and we see crisis. Well, we can have hope in crisis. We can have confidence and peace in crisis. Because God is faithful to his promise. He has promised if you believe in him, that he will not forsake you. He will not leave you. He will take care of you. And you have hope for a better future. And so what Jeremiah says is that we should do this morning is let's examine our ways. Let's test our hearts. Because true hope in crisis comes from God, because God is faithful. And his track record is 100%. So lift our hearts, lift our hands to God in heaven and cry out to him. Call on his promises to those who believe in him and in his son and trust him. I want to leave you with these words from Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 26, verses 3 to 4. Isaiah says this about God. He says, "You will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast because they trust in you. Trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord himself is the rock eternal. Great is his faithfulness. Because of his faithfulness, he is constant with his promises. And every day that we wake up, despite what's going on in the world around us, we wake up knowing his mercy is new today. He is faithful to me today because he promised. And my hope, my faith, my trust, my belief is in a God who is real. And his son who died for me so that I can have hope no matter what happens outside." I'm going to pray here in just a moment for us. And then after I'm done praying, Pastor Jerry and I are going to head back to our offices. And if this hope, if this peace, if this belief in God's faithfulness is something that you need to talk to us about, you can call us in exactly 5 minutes when I'm done. You can call us. You can see our phone number is 814-864-8811. You can call us. You can email us there at our email addresses. And just talk to us about this confidence, this hope. How can I have this hope? How can I have this trust that God is faithful? How can I have the promise that God has made to those who believe in him? And so in just 5 minutes, if you want to give us a call so we can talk to you about that, we want to help you during this time. Will you pray with me? God, I thank you that we know as a fact that you are faithful 100% to your promise. And just as Jeremiah was confident that you've been faithful to your promise to Israel, we can be confident that you are faithful to your promise to your children, that you will never leave us or forsake us. You will never turn your back on us. You will comfort us. You will guide us. You will be with us no matter what happens outside, and that you have promised, "I will save you," and there is nothing worse that can happen to you, that we get to spend our eternity in heaven with you if we believe. I love you, God. Would you please give us that peace and that confidence that every day that we wake up, you have been faithful. You have been constant. You are still God. The King is still on his throne, and we can trust you because our hope is in a God who loves unconditionally. Thank you, God. I pray this in your name. Amen.